Open loops. Do, do. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend. I'm your host, your cultural hypnotist, other than conscious thought leader, transformational entertainer, and curator of experience. Put all those things together and you get Chief Looper, Greg Bornstein. Now, what is an open loop? It's a term that I first heard in the hypnosis land, but comes from advertising, comes from storytelling. An open loop is a provocation for your unconscious. The cliffhanger, the dot, 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 the thing that makes you wonder, what is he going to say? That's right. And the best part about this show is that we embrace the unexplained, the unknown. Yes, my goal is to challenge your existing belief systems, whether that's with me or with different guests who are going to share radically unique ideas to stimulate your unconscious mind so you can step into the highest version of yourself. Today's guest lives in that world, and I have been a huge fan of his for a long time. He's starting a podcast pretty soon, and I said, I need to snag him before he goes off and becomes podcast famous for all his really, really different ideas about the way the mind works, and the way change works, and the way hypnosis works. His name is James Tripp. Now, this conversation went so long, and it didn't feel like it went long at all. I have to break it up. All this week, it's going to be pure James Tripp. Three episodes, about a three-hour conversation, a little under 3 hours. And it's called Reality Without Trance, Deep Hypnosis Dialogues. Now, why is it called that? Because originally, I learned of James from Hypnosis Without Trance. He was someone going online, showing people that you didn't need to drop them into a formal induction. I know I've spoken about this on earlier episodes. You could twist the way that someone's experiencing reality in real time with a selection of words leading people in such a fashion that their perception, their experience, their feelings gradually transformed without them needing to conk out or just be in this state of trance. I mean, he was doing remarkable things. Most impressive thing, he was conversationally, and I mean conversationally, without trance, really, without trance, able to cause a negative hallucination. For those of you that don't know what that is, that's making yourself invisible for someone sitting there in real life. All of a sudden, they can't see you there. There's a video that he did of that. And I said, how he got that hypnotic phenomena without bringing the person to close their eyes and deepening the trance and then waking them up and saying, now I'm invisible. That's radical. How did he discover this? Because he's an explorer. That's what I love about James Tripp. So, this first part of the dialogue, which I titled The Magic of Structure, is a nod to two hypnotists and the original NLP founders, John Grinder, Richard Bandler, their first book, it could have been their second book, really. I think they did one about Virginia Satir. But it was called The Structure of Magic, where they were breaking down language patterns from this family therapist, Virginia Satir, and distilling what she was doing to create radical transformation. And this dialogue is about me going, hey, James, you've broken down hypnosis into this structure. Is the magic left? And I believe by the time you walk away from this, you might believe that magic is real. He put the magic back into hypnosis, even though he's managed to deconstruct it. He sees the structure, and then from the structure is able to put it in framework that you can't help but believe that something beyond regular reality is happening. You are getting hypnotized without being in a formal trance, and your reality is bending. Even by this dialogue that I had with him, I experienced that shift. It was a shift in reality without trance, and I experienced that the entire 3 hours. I'm so excited to share this with you. If there's anybody you know that wants to go on a mind bend and really understand hypnosis at a profoundly deep level, please make sure to share the Open Loops podcast, as well as help put this dialogue out there. If you could please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and rate the show and leave a review, that would help a lot. Without further ado, so honored he came on. And he's going to explain it in a much more articulate way than I ever could. Part one, Reality Without Trance. James Tripp, The Magic of Structure. We have James Tripp, a wonderful, wonderful hypnosis trainer. He's a change worker, a blogger, explorer, psychonaut, hypnosis developer as well, and all around just really a multidisciplinary person in the way that I love. Everything from the three principles to Eastern philosophy to, you know, shamanic healing. I mean, all different kinds of stuff. And the through line is hypnosis, which is what I'm doing this show for. So I am honored to introduce him. James, thank you so much for coming on Open Loops.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Greg. It's really good to be here.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked about your work in prior episodes, and actually I did a series where I was contrasting the early stages of the apprenticeship that you have versus Mike Mandel's training, and not going into the concepts because I obviously want people to invest in the course. I'm really kind of doing it as a commercial for people to check this work out. But I was looking at the overall framework. Here's two different people that have radically strong views about hypnosis, and here's where the commonalities are, and here's the differences. Let's start here. You were the first person that I saw that was really publicly going around and saying, hey, this doesn't need trance. I mean, it was called Hypnosis Without Trance. And it resonated with me deeply, because at a time when I was in my exploration, similar to you, like I started as a magician, started watching Darren Brown, really loved his work, and always had a fascination for hypnosis. But once I saw Darren, the worlds came together. This is amazing. He brought it. And I wanted to do that quick, rapid sleep, drop down. And everybody was teaching trance stuff. And you were like, hey, you don't even need this. And you can get the phenomena that happens after they've been in trance. I thought it was magical back then. Do you still see your view of hypnotic phenomena and the tranceless aspect as magical?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because, I've been teaching hypnosis for over 10 years now. And when I first came out with the Hypnosis Without Trance thing, I was probably a bit more, quote unquote, scientifically minded in my approach to things. So I was looking to break down what's really going on here. And that was a kind of useful process because it meant that I could approach things experimentally and, you know, look at what added up and what didn't. And it became clear to me that this whole idea that I'd been taught that certain hypnotic phenomena were deep trance phenomena and they needed this sort of depth of trance, it just didn't add up. So I started to look at what was really going on here and try and figure things out in a way that made sense to me. And one of the things that started to kind of concern me was that I was actually, in doing this, in revealing what was going on, I was kind of, in some ways, killing the magic of it, if that makes sense. And I was also aware that the magic of it, the experience of something different, something special, something wondrous, is actually quite key to making the stuff work. So if you strip it of all magic and strip it of all mystery, a lot of what drives engagement in hypnosis actually kind of disappears as well. So I was always aware, like kind of early on, and I remember saying to people, I'm trying to figure out how to teach this. It's almost like I'm trying to take away the magic, but without taking the magic away. You know, and I think there's some real value in saying, okay, so what's going on here? Let's kind of lay this bare and look at the mechanisms of it. But you've got to make sure it gets put back together again and it comes alive. When you do the work, it's got to be alive. It's got to be something wondrous that people engage with, something that gives them a sense that they just stepped out of everyday reality, not just, you know. So what I wanted to do is explain hypnosis without explaining it away. Explain it in a way that was useful for people in terms of nuts and bolts and mechanics. But what's really, really important to me as well is that people, that it is magical. You know, it is magical, even though I believed hypnosis is about, I mean, the practice of hypnosis, actually working with other people, is about leading them in how they are shaping their experience neurocognitively in the moment. They're doing it anyway, whether you're leading them or not. But, you know, so you're working with processes that are at play anyway. But those processes themselves are actually fundamentally magical, so far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly the overall mission of this podcast, is really the tension between explaining away magic and how magic and explaining into magic. And that's sort of what I've categorized as looping. Intellectual escapism. What kind of thoughts make your brain go off into an imaginative place? But also, can you look at the imaginative places of the world, i.e. what happens when you're in a hypnotic trance, per se, and in having a hallucination, and then break that down in a way that makes you go, wow, the way that's built is very magical. And I kind of look at that as a loop and an interesting tension between that. Yeah, your work and your work is that. You were one of the first people that I got the phrase reality tunnel from, which I know comes from Robert Anton Wilson, who is...
It actually comes from Timothy Leary.
Oh, right. Yeah, you love Robert Anton Wilson's works, don't you?
Oh, I do. I do love Robert Anton Wilson. And yes, and he is where I got the phrase from, or the way of looking at things. But Robert Anton Wilson got that from Timothy Leary. Often with these things, as an old mentor of mine said, the roots of this stuff go way back and all over the place.
Yeah.
And that really is true.
What is, in your research, the connection between hypnosis and the stuff that Timothy Leary was doing, you think, overall?
Well, you know, I'm not overly familiar with Leary's stuff. I mean, my only real exposure to Timothy Leary is via Robert Anton Wilson and via John Higgs' biography of him, which is called I've Got America Surrounded or something like that, I think, which was an excellent read. But I do think it's interesting if you kind of look, because he's there exploring with psychedelics back in the 60s. And I think a lot of what he's doing with psychedelics is kind of similar to perhaps what I do with hypnosis. There are principles in common. And I think really what the start point is I got this idea that, you know, we live our lives, if we want to use the term trances, we live through trances. We're always in one kind of a trance or another. We're never experiencing the world as it is, only as it is occurring to us through how we're making it up in the moment. Now, these trances, they're habitual. So we've got, we sort of live through what I call a trance repertoire. And we build this trance repertoire as we're growing up, and then it generally stabilizes as we become adults. And as our trance repertoire stabilizes, we sort of solidify, and change becomes more and more challenging. It becomes a less and less default position because we're constantly working to put ourselves back together the same way all the time, unconsciously. So I think if you look at some of the stuff that perhaps Leary was doing with psychedelics and these sorts of things, he's chemically inducing the blowing out of existing structures to organize people's reality.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I think when you blow those structures out, you've got underneath of this, I sometimes talk about what I call the generative faculty, you see, because who built those reality tunnels in the first place? Who built that trance repertoire in the first place? There is a generative intelligence within us that builds all that we think we are as we grow up. And once it's sort of done its work, it kicks back and gets lazy. And what it's built runs the show. But I think when you blow out what has been built, that generative intelligence sort of has to come back online and put new things in place. And often they can be better adapted things than the old things. So, you know, and I approach that like when I'm looking at change work, I'm looking at, okay, what is it that this person needs to let go of? What do we need to blow out so that we can create the space to create something new with them? And I think psychedelics can do that. And I think there's a lot of ways you can do that with quote unquote hypnosis as well.
Yeah. Do you think also, I mean, I know that from watching your videos that you've referenced people like, well, you've referenced magical and occult sort of practices and shamanic, I said earlier, things that a lot of the times when I talk to, I've had shamans on the show and witches, and I bring up hypnosis and they don't really understand it. And I'm going, yeah, it's, I mean, they're always interested, but I'm always surprised that I feel like as an explorer, like you are looking at these different fields for commonalities. And even Richard Bandler, you know, at the beginning of Structure of Magic, he references Carlos Castaneda. I mean, I know that he was into meta magic and stuff like that. What would you say, are there occultic sort of connections as well that people don't even realize are there worth exploring?
I think that's an interesting question in that the answer sort of goes in two directions, probably in many directions, but in two directions. You were saying there that you've spoken to sort of shamanic practitioners and they're not necessarily seeing the connection with hypnosis.
Yeah.
In a sense, something that Robert Keegan, the developmental psychologist, has said about psychotherapy is he said at its very most basic level, psychotherapists are inviting their clients into a different language culture. Now, I think this is interesting, particularly, you know, let's cross this over. Let's play fast and loose with magical frames. If you think of the idea of abracadabra, meaning I create as I speak, from the old Aramaic,
right?
I create as I speak. Now, the interesting thing is what do words do? How do words shape experience? Now, I think they're significant in shaping experience, or more specifically, the concepts that sit underneath words. So we go back to reality tunnels again. What Robert Keegan's saying is a psychotherapist operates from within a particular reality tunnel. When he talks about language cultures, they sit there in a particular language tunnel. They sit in a particular organization of reality, and they invite their clients to come and spend time in that organization of reality. It's very different from the one that they're living their everyday life in. And ideally, it offers different choices and even better still, higher levels of functionality back in their everyday life. So the fact that the client comes and spends time in this different reality tunnel with the psychotherapist, as far as I'm concerned, that's the mechanism of hypnosis right there.
Yes.
Now, let's take away psychotherapist and let's put, I don't know, traditional Chinese medicine practitioner instead. They are also inviting their client to partake in a reality tunnel. So is a shamanic healer. So is a three principles practitioner. So is. It doesn't matter. Everybody is coming from an organization of reality, every practitioner of every kind of craft, and they are inviting somebody to partake in that. And I think the degree to which that person, you know, if that person partakes fully in it, they've just got hypnotized, if you like. Right?
Yeah.
So in a sense, like, take away the name hypnosis. Really, we're just talking about reality bending, reality shaping. We're talking about how we engage with reality. And I think that's all the same in a lot of ways. Now, on the flip side of that, I said it goes in two directions. If you trace back the history of hypnosis has got, originally came, you know, had that influence from magnetic healing and this kind of thing, mesmerism. And that has got its background in all sorts of kind of Western esoteric stuff. And there's a whole thread that comes from the sort of yogic, the sleep yoga stuff and all of that kind of thing for the sleep temples. So right. All of this stuff in kind of interweaves and intertwines. I think ultimately what we're looking at is if you track back in history, there's an idea. I'm no scholar of this, but there's an idea that if you look at the sort of basic shamanic beliefs all over the world that go way, 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 way back, there's a real strong commonality between them. And there's one theory that they actually came out of Africa, like they're that old. There's certain ways of engaging at a fundamental level that are that old. They go way back to the very, very first human beings in Africa. And as they came out and traveled around the world, they brought these beliefs with them. And I think they're ways of making sense of the world that are fundamentally influenced by our neurophysiology. So I think there's a lot in shamanism that's very reflective of how we as human beings do sense making at a fundamental level. So I think there's some real kind of archetypal stuff in the mix there. And I found that allowing more of that to come through into, say, my hypnosis work or change work has been a very, very powerful thing. I think it's working with really primal stuff with people. And I think good hypnosis is as well. So I think we're just ultimately working with human beings and how they are. So yeah. Hence the commonalities.
Yeah. No, that's a really, as I expected, it was a really interesting answer. And I reflect on sort of the, I don't know, I know this is coming from the ego, but there's a part of me, James, that always thinks about that old Bandler, Grinder dialogue of there's no such thing as hypnosis or everything is hypnosis, both of them saying that one after the other. And I, you know, sometimes I feel a little guilty on the inside, and here's why. There's a part of me that's going, yeah, you say you're a shamanic healer, but I know this is really just based in hypnosis. You say that you're doing Reiki. Yeah, but this is all just like kind of suggestion, or at least it's connecting to the principles of hypnosis. And the way, I mean, I know that you're giving credit to both sides of it, the fact that it comes from this tribal culture, which means I don't think they were actively doing, well, I don't think they thought of it as a mind science. It was a primal, full body, really embodied transformational experience a lot of the times. And so I wonder, though, but I also know for a fact that on the flip side of that, some of the best hypnosis practitioners are making sure that it is embodied, or the body is the way to get to the transformation. So I guess I wonder this. If I'm sitting here looking at these different spiritual disciplines and secretly in my mind going, yeah, but it's really all just kind of hypnosis. Is that necessarily true? Because I kind of, in my gut, feel like it is.
Right. So here's the thing. What I'm going to suggest that you're doing there, Greg, is you're looking at these other things and going, yeah, those things are really just X.
Yeah.
Right. As in they're not real as such as they believe themselves to be, because they are in fact X. But the X is also just as unreal as all those other things.
Oh, right.
So here's like Here's where you lose cabin pressure. Hypnosis isn't real either.
Oh, man.
So now, like, when I say it isn't real, what I mean by that is I'm very fond of the Heisenberg quote, which is probably not from Heisenberg. I don't know. But it's what you're trying to understand is not any more complex than you think. It's more complex than you can think. Right? So we make it up in a particular way. When we make up, right, we're going to try and understand a set of dynamics, and we make it up, and we call what we make up hypnosis. And that's still just a map. It's not the territory, right? You could have made it up differently and made it up as shamanism. It's still a map. It's not the territory. Now, like, I really used to believe that how I had hypnosis made up, when I thought, right, what's really going on here, I thought that it was truer than the way hypnosis had been made up before, you know, the with the trance model and all of this, or I thought it was truer than energy work, because I actually came in originally through like Qigong and stuff like that and energy work. And I sort of questioned that, and I decided, well, maybe that's really hypnosis. But, you know, my friend Melissa Tier, she says this stuff is all made up. She puts it slightly more strongly than that. And like, everything is made up. Ultimately, we make up the complexity of reality into something simpler that we can understand. And then we go, oh yeah, that's right. It's like Newtonian mechanics. Like that seemed like that once upon a time, Newtonian mechanics was the cutting edge of physics. And it's like, well, that's what the world works like. And then along comes, you know, Einstein and says, no, actually it's nothing like that at all. But still we use Newtonian mechanics in structural engineering and that kind of thing, because it's the most useful map. It's the most useful way of understanding, but it still isn't really how things are. It's just a way of making sense of them. So this is why, for me, hypnosis is both real and not real. There's no such thing as hypnosis, because it's just a way of making sense of something.
Mm.
Now, I'm highly pragmatic. I just want to go, well, when I make sense of it this way, what kind of results do I get? What kind of results unfold from this kind of way of sense making? So I'm quite happy. This is why, like, people don't get this. I often mess around with all sorts of stuff that people would call magic, like out and out magic. I'm not talking about card magic or close up magic.
Right.
I'm talking about like magic. And I would have laughed at myself for doing so. If I go back, my self of 10 years ago mocks me now for being an incredulous fool, for being a credulous fool.
Right.
Right. But here's the thing. What I've discovered is when you go into a different experience of reality from within yourself, and you really go in, right, and you experience it fully and completely from the inside out, it changes your engagement with the world, and it changes the results that you get. And I don't even pretend to know how that works or why that works. I can explain it in within the paradigms of that will be acceptable to modern psychology, but I think in explaining it that way, it explains some of it away, and therefore reduces the efficacy of it. So what I've learned to do now is I used to, 10 years ago, I might play a frame in hypnosis. I might play what I would call an energy frame and say, well, I'm going to do some stuff with energy. And inside I'd be thinking, this person believes in energy, so I can use this frame to leverage for suggestion purposes. I don't do that anymore. Now I say, okay, you know, some people call what we're about to experience chi or energy, right? And nobody really knows what this is, and maybe it isn't even a thing scientifically. However, when you're open to engaging with the experience, extremely interesting things can happen. Now, this is the thing. It's like, what are the realities you are capable of manifesting within your own neurology? So I can now go into a completely, you know, for example, shamanic reality, and I can believe it inside out. I can go into the phenomenology of it. When I do, it will change how I show up and engage, and it changes the impact I have on the person that I'm working with. Now, I'm not saying it always changes it for the better. I'm just saying having that choice to be malleable in one's own reality without worrying about, but is that really the truth? I don't know the truth, because the truth is not any more complex than I think. It's more complex than I can think. So, I know that's probably like a head job for a lot of people listening, and they might just think it's complete nonsense. But I think it's the nexus of doing really powerful work, certainly within hypnosis and probably in any other area where you're engaging with another human being to help them make changes.
That is so, oh my gosh. Yes, yes. This is the experience I get watching your courses. It really is. You are opening up doors in my mind that were previously unopened before. You know what? This is interesting too, because I know I did notice in the past, maybe like 3 or 4 years, that you've used generative a lot more in your work, that phrase. And I know it's, well, the guy who wrote the book, Stephen Gilligan, there's generative trance, but you know, it's been going on forever. I find this interesting. You were talking about this feels like, okay, hypnosis 101 is meeting the person where they're at. And I mean, Jerry Kine talked about, there was somebody of the, I believe it was a Jewish client. So he donned a yarmulke and he came in and met the person, meeting them there, and then performed the ritual, brought them in, gave them the regression, and it helped more. Then as I've gone deeper into this, even Kenrick Cleveland, who is one of the great persuasion and influence minds out there, he used to be all about values elicitation and meeting the person where they're at. And now he's talking about a whole nother level of meeting somebody, being like, hey, let's start with where you are and add possibilities, as opposed to really zoning in on where you're at and just kind of digging into the pre-existing pain. What is this move in general to generative sort of work with people that you think is better than just really doing traditional quote unquote rapport building?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, that point about meet people where they're at, it's a basic pacing and leading move.
Yes.
And the thing about pacing and leading is it's never pacing and pacing and pacing and pacing and pacing. It's pacing and leading. So there's, as far as I'm concerned, yeah, meet people where they're at. But the intention is always one of transformation, expansion, generation, these sorts of things. I'm kind of like, I'm actually better at doing it than I've ever been, in that I'm really happy for people to be where they're at. And I've kind of got good in change work at tailoring what I think people need. Now, that's going to sound very arrogant to some listeners. Giving people what I think they need whilst apparently giving them what they want. And it took me a long time to get good at that, like doing it really elegantly, so it didn't look like I was trying to give somebody something different from what they thought they needed. So right. That's kind of, you know, so I'll meet people where they're at, like, you know, what do you want? What's your outcome? What would you love to get from this session? And if somebody came up with what struck me as an impossible outcome, I'd try and show them it was an impossible outcome so we could get on the same page and work together. Now I just go, yeah, okay. And get busy delivering that to them. The term generative, by the way, generative to me, the thing that sort of resonates for me about the term generative is that generative is about what can come from something that is of value that you might not necessarily know ahead of time, or you wouldn't necessarily know ahead of time. So there's that line from Steve Jobs, which I love very much, which is, you cannot connect the dots looking forward, only looking backward. The trouble is with change work is, a lot of the time, if somebody comes in and they give you an outcome, that outcome was chosen from within the rule set that shapes the problem trumps, right? So the same thinking that's creating the problem is trying to create the solution. And what that usually does, I call this being recruited by the problem. So people actually do not need the outcome that they think they need. They actually need something different. So I could decide outside, well, I've got a better outcome and I'm going to go for this with them. And maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. But it's still very linear. It's still, we're going from there to there. We specify ahead of time what the solution is. Generativity is much more about engaging in a process whereby sort of self-organizing systems can come into play and create outcomes that no narrow beam of consciousness would ever have picked ahead of time. So I'm happy for the intelligence of the system to create solutions that go beyond what I might have picked as the solution or the client might have picked as the solution, and also create conditions for yet further useful and good things to come out of that. So also the, another aspect of generativity for me is the kind of snowball effect of the work, that once something gets rolling, a lot more changes accrue. So maybe a client might come in for nail biting. I don't do this kind of work anymore. I don't do these kind of issue specific things that much anymore. But let's say a client comes in for nail biting. You know, I would much prefer that the client not just went away. I'd rather they went away happy and having their mind blown and like being in a different place in their life and just seeing all manner of things differently. And in amongst the mix, they've got some different choice around nail biting, or they've chosen something different. But I don't want to be too attached to that outcome. So I just want change to beget change to beget more change.
Yeah, why isn't everybody going there? If hypnosis can do it, that's always my thought. I'm going, this thing is so powerful and this is the next level, I get that it's more marketable. I have an issue, fix it. But I also wonder, will there be a world where hypnosis has to evolve and practitioners are just doing this generative type of work in addition to where they're at currently?
I don't know. I think one of the problems is, well, it's not a problem. It's just the way it is. It's that people are often fundamentally, a lot of people want a simple life. So, I mean, for me, hypnosis has changed my whole world and my whole reality in so many ways. And I often say it isn't the fact that I learned hypnosis. It's what I learned from hypnosis about human psychosocial dynamics and all sorts of crazy stuff that's enriched my life in so many ways. But a lot of people, they're not really into that journey. And this is on both sides. This is on the practitioner side and this is on the client side. A lot of practitioners, they're like, you know, I remember like Jeffrey Stevens, who I was friends with before.
Yeah, I talk about him a lot. I did his training.
Right. So I remember Jeff saying to me, he said, James, the way you work would bore the shit out of me, he said.
Right.
Because now, and I said, Jeff, the way you work would bore the shit out of me. Right. Because like, I've got a lot of respect for Jeff, by the way. And I want to make this really, really clear, because we were friends and we saw things very, very differently and respected each other's work, but saw things very, very differently. Like Jeff used to like to go in and he had his process, his golden box process. He wanted to keep it super, super simple. He didn't want to explore. Right.
Yeah.
Now me, I'm like, we're not exploring. Where's the fun? You know, that is, I think it's like different interests. Some people, some people love to learn with me because they want to go down the rabbit hole and they want to explore. And other people are like, yeah, that James Tripp guy, he's not for me. I just want something simple that's going to work every time, a turnkey solution, because I just want to make money seeing clients. And I don't want to have to think too hard about it. So there are a lot of people in that place. I don't get that myself because I'm into this stuff because of the wonder of it, not because I just wanted to make a quick buck helping people stop biting their nails.
Yeah.
But also on the client side of it as well, you know, not everybody's up for a developmental journey. Which is why, by the way, if I do issue specific change work, I don't try and switch people across to that path. I just go, okay, yeah, let's see what we can get happening there with those nails. Right. But I'm still going to be doing more developmental work with them. And I think it sort of pays dividends, because if they go away and maybe they stop biting their nails, but they go, something else is really different, I just feel so much more relaxed in myself and I'm enjoying my life more, there's more likelihood they're going to come back. And I do more developmental coaching these days to people anyway. So that's what I prefer doing. If I do issue specific change work, because I stopped advertising for it, that doesn't mean I don't do it. It just means I don't advertise that I do it.
Yeah.
People still ask me, but these days, a lot of people that I do see for issue specific change work end up hiring me for developmental coaching because they got so much from the session that they want more. They want to see what else is possible for them. So that's where I like to go.
I've always wondered about your coaching. You know, do you do, I mean, you're doing hypnosis without trance, that's the name, but when you see your coach with a hypnosis background, I mean, what do people come in expecting, and how much of the ritual aspects of hypnosis end up happening?
Okay, that's a good question, and the answer is it depends. Less and less and less of the ritual aspects happen now. That's the truth of it. Now, I'm not going to say I don't do ritual aspects ever at all, because I do, and it's now blurring in terms of what is ritual and what's not, what is formal process and what's not. You know, for example, I mean, I was working with a client the other day, and their body was tightening and their breathing had got shallow, and I could see that they got lost in a sort of micro trance of agitation. And as they were speaking, I just looked at them and I said, and I held up my finger and they stopped and I went, slowing down. Now, there's a whole lot of body language you can't see here with this.
Yeah. Right?
And they went, and their whole physiology changed and they shifted. And this is a client, and he went, wow, that slowing down thing. Like, this is the next session, he said to me. He said, that slowing down thing blew my mind. He said, can we do more stuff like that? Now, the question is, was that conversational or was it ritual? Was it formal process?
Right.
Was it conversational, right? In a sense, it's a little piece of microprocessing. And it's a simple thing, and it blew the guy away so much. He said it just kept coming back to him, like, throughout the week afterwards. He'd get into situations where he'd be tensing up and he would just slow down in this way that I'd evoked in the moment. So I kind of do things like that, but generally speaking, I don't make a plan ahead of time as to whether I'm going to do more formal stuff. Occasionally, I might even do a very formal thing and say, okay, let's just do a little bit of process around that. Close your eyes for a moment and connect with this. But generally speaking, I'm working conversationally mostly, because I'm tracking their reality and how it's being organized in the moment. And I'm looking to introduce shifts in that so as they can experience difference, which then opens up. And again, I'm working with their generative faculty. Once certain structures get out the way, they start creating new solutions for themselves really, really rapidly. So I do a lot of that.
Yeah. Was that what you would describe? I mean, one of the questions that I had that you brought up earlier that opened the loop in my head was, you're like, I'm doing magic now. And the 10 years ago guy that was doing this stuff would look at this guy now and be like, what? I mean, to me, what you traditionally see, especially when I got into hypnosis early, was there was a magic in watching Milton Erickson on camera start to tell a story, and it was a long-winded sentence, and the person would just kind of go out into trance. And then to me, it's much more magical and much more Derek Brown-like to say a word and, you know, hold up your hand like you did, or finger, and get that person to go in there. I mean, the simplicity is magical to me. Can you give me an example of something that James Tripp from 10 years ago would look at today and be like, yeah, you would have never done that? What is magic right now?
Okay, so here's a really, really simple example, something I do a lot, which I never would have done before. I literally go into a space where I recreate the person right in front of me in my mind, and I breathe what I recreate in them to them.
Wow.
Now, and I'll do this while they're telling me their problem. So while somebody's telling me a problem or a situation or a stuck thing, I'm sitting there remodeling them. I'm like I go into a sort of very, you could call it going into a trance. I go into a trance myself and I remodel them, quote unquote, magically. And I breathe those changes and those transformations to them. And here's the thing. Now, I'm aware this is not proof of anything, what I'm about to say, because we've got confirmation bias systems and all sorts of stuff in place. But I'm not doing science here. I'm doing magic. So it doesn't matter. I'm not trying to discover something. I'm just doing something. When I do this, regularly people's physiology shifts right in front of me. Regularly. It's a standard thing. I wouldn't keep doing it if it didn't continue to pretty much effectively have these results. I actually started to do this in manual therapy, because my background before hypnosis was manual therapy. I trained as an osteopath for 3 years, and I carried on doing some manual therapy work just for friends and family. I have done for the last 15 years or so, and I used to do my manual therapy very technically. So I'd be aware, I'd be assessing things, palpating for where there were tensional patterns being held, and I'd be computing in my mind and going, right, this is the origin of this muscle here, and the insertion here could be a referral from that, very left brain process. And I dropped doing that, and I switched to a very right brain process where I would literally just drop into a reality of feeling in and almost asking the silent question, what is it that needs to happen here? And then whatever answer came up, it would come up non-verbally within the whole experience of the moment, and I would just let the experience of the moment follow it. And as soon as I started doing this, I started to get I never told the people I was working with I was doing this. I started to get really different feedback. They'd go, whoa, what did you just do? I'd be like, I have no idea. Because the things I was doing with my hands were very different. My touch got lighter.
Huh.
So, and I'm not claiming this is supernatural, by the way. I have no clue as to the how this yeah. works, right? I make no claims to anything. I just know that when I shifted my way of doing it from the inside out, the experience on the client side changed. And I got reports back, and I would get things like, you know, being asked, how are you doing that? How do you know that? Did you know this? And I'm like, I have no idea. This is a different realm for me. So I started to do this in the manual therapy. And then I just thought, what if I did this when I'm doing change work and hypnosis? What if I just do the same thing? What if I start assuming that I can affect change in a mysterious way, like apparently I'm doing here? So I started doing it with hypnosis and change work and similar sorts of results. People just letting go of stuff, releasing things. So I can offer, obviously we human beings, we're mammals, and we, you know, like a horse can pick up on people's state of being and tune in and that sort of thing. And it isn't necessarily psychic or anything like that. It's just, you know, call it whatever, limbic resonance, I don't know. There's just the tuning in. And when you tune in with people, and you inquire of a different part of your being as to what might need to happen, and then you just allow that to unfold and manifest, weird stuff happens. So I do that kind of thing all the time. I have no idea, can't explain it, got no explanation for it. I just do it, and it creates interesting results.
Yeah. What you're speaking to also is the excitement that I have when I go back and read the early NLP books and some of the stuff that was happening with, I mean, even some of Milton Erickson's stuff of yeah. experimenting. I mean, is there anybody else? This is really the explorer thing. Okay, to me, the coolest thing in the world is deep trance identification. Mm. It's such a cool thing to me. This idea of stepping into somebody and having all your memories of them and then going in turn. I mean, I've done this with people and seen their entire physiology and demeanor change in a way that makes me go, yeah, this isn't just play acting. Mm. There is something unconscious that they're taking on when they embody this person. I love it so much. Is anybody else looking into the cutting edge possibilities like you are? I feel like you have a responsibility, James, to keep doing this because it is what's magical about it.
Right. I mean, I think there are people, but they're not necessarily hypnotists. I don't know if you know Jules Lalonde. Do you know Jules
in
Canada?
Okay. No,
so Jules is a super interesting guy. He's a friend of mine in Canada, and he's a super smart guy. He's a complex systems modeler and has worked in high finance and stuff like that. So really, you know, he's really probably got an IQ of goodness knows what. But he's a completely open, you know, very scientific guy. He can be very scientific, but he's completely open to exploration. So he does a lot of shamanic journeying and things like that. I think there's a lot of people out there that, you know, really are willing to let go and explore. And I think for myself, I've always said, if I stop learning interesting new things from the work that I do, I'll stop doing the work that I do. Because I'm doing it to explore. And this is one of the things, like, you know, the fact that I work with clients is secondary. I was an explorer of the nexus of mind and life first.
Yes.
And second, after doing that for many years in many different contexts, sort of thought, well, you know, maybe I could do some client work with people and start helping other people move their minds, instead of just kind of exploring, and do it a bit more professionally. So I came to that afterwards. So I do think there are people out there exploring, but most people just want to get something simple that works. Like this, back to that point again, people want, well, what's the thing that's always going to help my clients stop smoking every single time?
Yeah.
Now I'm at a place now, I don't advertise for change work anymore, as I've already mentioned several times. When people do come and hire me for change work, still, I'm very, very relaxed about it. I mean, yeah, there's a part of me, of course, I want to help them get their outcome, but I'm not actually that attached to them getting their outcome. You know, I'm just really attached to sitting down with them and seeing what the hell we can open up in their world that's going to make the big difference for them. So that's the thing that's interesting to me. And also, like, the freedom from being attached to their outcome enables me to kind of explore. And I'm exploring for them. I'm not exploring for me in that situation. I really want the outcome for them, but I want us to explore our way to the outcome through possibility rather than me, like, with a tight grip, go, right, this is the process I'm going to run to get you your outcome. You know, it's interesting you say, by the way, as well, about the sort of early days of NLP and the magic and the promise of NLP.
Yeah.
In terms of magic, because I do think, you know, I used to be an NLP trainer, and there's a culture of NLP in the UK, which I think has got a little bit superficial in some ways. Everybody does short practitioners, and then they're a practitioner, they're a master practitioner. It's not like, if you look at how the NLP people of the 70s, they spent years playing with stuff.
Yes.
They didn't do 2 7-day courses and become a master practitioner. They explored. The Banner and Grinder and Puslik and all the other people involved were exploring for a considerable amount of time across a number of years. They were really living in it and immersing themselves in it and finding out what happened when you did this or what happened when you did that. And I always looked at that and thought, oh, that would have been incredible to be in that environment. And one of the things from early on for me is I knew I wasn't in that environment, so I had to create it the best that I could. And so some people, like, look at my older videos and go, oh, James, you know, there were you out doing street hypnosis. The only reason I was out doing street hypnosis was because that was a laboratory for me. It was a place to discover things. It was an opportunity to explore. It wasn't because I had a burning yearning to do street hypnosis. I just needed a place to explore, and I was looking for as many places as possible. That was that. And now I'm just kind of like, well, what's the next most interesting thing? And my interest has sort of moved away from the places that it was at, and I'm much more interested now in how, when we shift our own reality, what happens as a result?
Yeah, you've definitely laid the groundwork for me to keep being interested in hypnosis. I can't even imagine being in your position where I'm coming up with different frames and ways of looking at this stuff and then leading on to the next thing. My position is, oh my gosh, I'm worried that James Tripp is going to get tapped out. Like, what happens if you finalize stuff? I mean, do you have faith that this field is going to keep being interesting to you? And if so, how do you have that faith?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And I think partly it's to do with how one defines the field and how one sets the scope of the field. Here's an interesting thing. Like, I often teach people, I don't know if I've ever taught this publicly, but privately, I say, look, here's the thing. Nobody knows what hypnosis is. So that means, as a hypnotist, you get to define it. You get to define the parameters of it. because you know, no two hypnotists can decide what it is.
Yeah.
They get a general idea. It's like trying to decide what art is, and you can debate forever and ever. There's no rigid definition. So because there's no solid definition of what hypnosis is, people actually, you know, you can include what you want and exclude what you want, and you can play fast and loose with the boundaries and the parameters. Also, if nobody knows what hypnosis is, nobody knows what a hypnotist is.
Hmm.
So you get to create yourself as whatever kind of hypnotist you want to be, doing whatever kind of hypnosis you want to do. Now, when you look at it like that, it's like, well, how could the scope be anything other than infinite?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. I also am just intrigued by your contributions to hypnosis, because if someone were to go through, I'm in your hypnosis apprenticeship program, and I've bought your courses over the years. Their online courses, really mind-blowing things. You have so many different reframes, definitions, concepts that I know that, you know, you would say, well, some of this comes from this and some of this comes from this, but also very original things. And it makes me go, James Tripp isn't just stripping away hypnosis or breaking it down differently. You're also creating a new language around it. And sometimes even, James, I mean, I'll admit that I get overwhelmed. I'm going through this person's book and I recognize the connections here. And then I go through James Tripp's world and it's an entire, it almost seems like a different galaxy of understanding of hypnosis. I mean, how do you feel about that as a creator? Like, I know your goal isn't to overwhelm people, but do you feel like you are really creating an entirely new, I suppose, reality with regards to the way we're looking at this?
I intend to, yes. And not for superficial reasons either. One of the things, this comes back to reality tunnels again, and this idea about inviting people into reality tunnels and shaping reality and experience. I've done a lot of self-development stuff. So beyond the world of hypnosis, I've spent time in NLP, I've spent time in three principles, in REBT, in Eugene Jennings focusing, in clean language, my old coach Steve Chandler's interesting reality.
Oh, I love Steve Chandler stuff. Yeah. Another person I found from you. Yes.
Right. So, you know, one of the things I remember being in it really struck me. I was in Los Angeles, this is probably like 6-7 years ago now, maybe even more. And it was the first time I kind of really stepped into the Steve Chandler world. And it was a Steve Chandler weekend seminar. And I was there. And what really struck me is, coming from an NLP world, is how different the reality tunnel was. But I mean in terms of phenomenology. Do you know what I mean by phenomenology? In terms of like my inner experience.
Mm.
It was like, it wasn't just different information. It was a different experience being evoked within me, with a different set of seeings and a different set of possibilities.
Wow.
From NLP, right? And I was just like, whoa. And that's why I hired Steve. After that, I was like, whoa, I'm going to hire this guy. Now, Steve is a wizard. He was my coach for a year, and I learned a phenomenal amount from Steve. Steve changed. I didn't just learn things. I didn't learn information. That's one of Steve's distinctions, information versus transformation. You know, I got transformation because time spent with Steve changed the way I saw the world, changed the way I experienced myself, changed everything. It's like an inside-out re-rendering of reality.
Yeah.
Now, to me, everything does this. Steve's good at it. But like NLP, you get immersed in the NLP world, it feels very, very different from the three principles world. It isn't just different information. It's a different experience. It's a different trance. So what I'm aware of is all communication is evocation. It's evoking trances within people. It's bringing people into a different organization of reality. So what I attempt to do when I'm exploring hypnosis ongoing is to take people on a journey into a very different way of seeing. It isn't merely about them having some intellectual understanding. It's a different way of seeing that I want to invite people into, because seeing creates being, being creates action in the world. That's the font of all change. So I'm kind of like, as I teach hypnosis, I'm kind of hypnotizing people into a different way of seeing things. And that's kind of part of what I do. And one of my, you know, I'll admit this. I know there's something like the online deep apprenticeship. Some people will come and they'll stay for a bit. Some people come and they stay for the long haul. I always intended, and I'm fine tuning it all the time, it's not even close to being finished, that program. I intend for people to come in thinking they're learning hypnosis and go out with a radically different experience of what's possible for themselves in the world. It's a self-development course in disguise as much as anything.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of hidden in the gaps. It's about having people become more empowered in themselves to create and shape their lives. But that's hidden between the gaps. They think they're learning hypnosis. They think they're going to be learning. Well, I'm switching it more towards learning change work now, but really it's about the inside out transformation they'll get as a byproduct.
That's part one. But what about mindfulness? Does it have limitations? What does James think about that? How about using hypnosis to get out of a parking ticket? What about other unethical things James Tripp has done with hypnosis, arguably unethical? Can you conversationally make someone see something that isn't there, covertly, without them even knowing you're doing it? Well, The Reality Without Trance Deep Hypnosis Dialogues, Part 2 and 3, will go into that. So make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoyed this podcast, again, if you could leave a rating and a review, it would greatly help. Talk soon.